Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. They're real clients. They're banking clients. They're trying to get rid of stocks.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Okay, everybody, welcome again to another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. I am Peter Schiff, host of the show for the next hour. We do this live every Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time, on my website, www.europac.net, and on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz. And the number to call, toll-free, to ask questions and make any comments is 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. These calls are not screened. I just take the calls in the order that they come in. And so feel free to speak your mind. Try to keep it short. Anyway, quick announcement on appearances. I will be on CNBC tomorrow on Thursday at 11 a.m. And I guess the name of the show is now called The Call. It's no longer called Morning Call because the host of Morning Call, Liz Claman, I think resigned. I don't know. I'm assuming she's going to be going over to Fox. So CNBC had to change the programming around. And so now it's an hour and a half show instead of a two-hour show. And I think they extended Squawk on the Street. But it's called The Call. But I'll be on at 11 o'clock at the top of the hour, maybe for about 10 minutes. So try to listen to that or set your recording devices. The big news, obviously, to talk about is the Bernanke came out on Tuesday and basically sounded the all clear once again. A lot of people were looking for Bernanke to make some statements to the effect that maybe he had a neutral bias or maybe he was likely to ease, but nothing. And I have been predicting that he would not do that. I have consistently predicted that the Fed cannot indicate that it's thinking about an ease. So, of course, Bernanke came out and said that, you know, he acknowledged the problems, you know, in the lending market to a limited degree, and he said that based on what's happening, the outlook for growth has been somewhat reduced. Now, I think that ranks as one of the greatest understatements of history. He's basically glossing over this disaster. And remember, the last time the Fed met, they basically, within their statement, they said that they mentioned the problems in the subprime market, and they said that they were contained. Right? Those were the exact words from the Fed. The problems look like they're likely to be contained to subprime. Obviously, they were wrong, right, because they're not contained to subprime. And now the Fed, of course, the Fed is saying that the problems are they're not acknowledging the severity of these problems. And of course, the market has now responded. It was up big yesterday. It's up another big move up today. And so the markets are looking at what Bernanke said, and they think, aha, everything must be okay because Ben Bernanke says it's okay, which is just it's absolutely ridiculous. But of course, that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to pretend that everything is okay. But you know, the real reason that Bernanke is not cutting rates, because you know damn well, you know he wants to cut rates. I mean, he wants to cut rates more than anything. The reason he's not is because of the dollar. And I've been talking about the dollar and this key level around 80. And the dollar index is around 80.2 right now. And it's poked its head below 80 a couple of times, but they've been able to hold it. And I think Bernanke knows that if they cut rates, that's it for the dollar. It's going to fall through the floor. And so the real reason he's not cutting rates is not because he thinks the economy is in good shape. He knows the economy is in lousy shape. He knows we're headed for recession, but he can't cut rates because he has to support the dollar. But, of course, he can't tell the truth. He can't tell the public, well, I'd like to cut rates. We're going into recession, but I can't because I don't want to piss off the Chinese and the Japanese who need to get a high rate of interest on the money that they've lent us. He can't admit to fix for it. So he has to continue to gloss over the problems of the market and talk about it like, you know, he's ready to hike. Because, of course, he needs to maintain the illusion that he's ready to raise interest rates. Of course, he's not going to do it. I mean, there's no way he's going to raise interest rates. It doesn't matter what the CPI is. He's not going to raise interest rates until the market forces him to. He's not going to be preemptive. But he constantly has to maintain the illusion that he's ready to tighten, because that's the only thing standing between the dollar and oblivion. And speaking about the dollar in oblivion, you know, there was an announcement today, and I have the report up on my website. It was the Telegraph report of the story, but they described Chinese threatens to use the nuclear option, meaning that the Chinese are basically saying if the U.S. government passes any of this protectionist legislation that it's now considering, that they will sell our currency and sell our bonds. And, of course, the typical CNBC reaction to this is that, oh, this is all bluff. They'll never do it because, you know, they're shooting themselves in the foot. You know, no, they're not. They're shooting us in the head. You know, it doesn't hurt. You know, they think they need us. You know, people keep saying, oh, we're China's best customer. We're not their best customer. We're their worst customer. We don't pay for anything, right? We don't export to pay for our imports. We just issue IOUs. And what can they do with them? Nothing. All they can do is loan them back to us and get more IOUs. But they're not converting them into consumer goods. You know, I put on my website today also an article on the Russian ruble and the strength of the ruble. And the reporter in the New York Times was reporting on the fact that the strengthening ruble, he was talking about all the benefits to Russia of the strong ruble and talking about the purchasing power that the Russian citizens are getting. And they showed pictures of Russians, you know, in a store buying some designer goods. And this was all thanks to the strengthening ruble. Well, the same thing would happen in China. You know, a stronger yuan is good for Chinese consumers. It's good for China. It's bad for America. But it's amazing, again, that all these, you know, journalists and Wall Street guys think that there's no way the Chinese would ever do this because it hurts them more than us, when the reality is it helps them and only hurts us. And so they should do it. They shouldn't just be using it as, you know, as a threat. But again, that's just another thing that the dollar doesn't need. So Bernanke knows that he's got to keep everybody thinking he's ready to tighten. Meanwhile, the Australian Central Bank tightened last night. Their rates are up to 6.5. The Bank of England is still talking like they're going to tighten soon. So is the ECB. So rates are going up. We know the Japanese eventually going to start raising rates. So rates are going up all over the world. How can the Fed unilaterally just say, oh, we're going to ease? They can't do it. But they don't want to admit that, so they look like idiots saying how great the economy is. The economy is in good shape. And, you know, it reminds me of a captain on a ship. And he's standing on the deck of the ship, and he's assuring all the passengers that the ship is sound, the ship is seaworthy. Meanwhile, you can see, you know, you can see the water rising, you know, and eventually, you know, he's up to his neck in water, yet he's still saying that the ship is fine, the ship's not going to sink. So, you know, then eventually you just see his hand waving, you know, his whole body's below water, and he's flashing the okay sign, you know, with his hand. I mean, this is what Bernanke looks like. But unfortunately, Bernanke has to keep saying that the economy is good. If he admitted that we were going into a recession, then he would have to cut, right? If he admitted we were going into recession. So he has to pretend that everything is great. Because he has to explain why he's not cutting rates, right? If he admits, yes, the economy is lousy, then Wall Street and the markets would be looking for him to cut rates. The fact that he's not cutting rates, you know, he has to say, well, I think the economy is good. And because the economy is so good, that's why I'm not cutting rates. He can't tell the truth. It's like, you know, the Jack Nicholson, the movie, you know, we can't handle the truth. So he's giving us a lie. Anyway, let me go to the phones. Let me take, is Ken then online from Minnesota? Ken, you there?
Peter, I know you're projecting like millions of people are going to be into foreclosure on their homes when the adjustable rates reset. Isn't it almost just as likely as a popular market commentator has been calling for in the last few days, and Hillary Clinton, and just today the housing secretary, that the Federal Reserve should simply you know, give a few hundred billion to Fannie Mae to buy up these subprime loans and just simply tell the banks, you know, you're not going to get your 5% up to 8%. You know, we're just going to reset all those, and basically that the government will come in and bail out the distressed homeowners, and in so doing, bail out the financial institutions, which have been under, their stocks have been depressed, but in the last 3 years,
we've
seen them rally.
Yeah, look, they're not really going to bail out anybody, because what they're going to do is they're going to try to create a market for these bonds, and basically what they're going to say is, okay, we will buy these subprime bonds off of you that are basically worthless. We're not going to give you 100 cents on the dollar. We're going to give you something for your money, which is better than nothing, so you're going to take a certain loss. Then what they're going to do is they're going to say, okay, they'll give the mortgage holders, the people that took out all these subprime mortgages that are about to reset, and say, okay, you know what? You can keep your low interest rates. You took out a teaser rate at 4%. It's going to reset to 8%. We'll let you stay at 4%. Now, of course, the minute that happens, these bonds collapse in value because they're not really worth very much. Now what's going to happen? What is Fannie Mae going to do with them? What is Freddie Mac? I mean, what are they going to do? I guess if the government's going to just give them the money to absorb that loss, where's the government going to get that money? Well, the government's going to have to convince the Chinese or the Japanese to lend it to us because we don't have it. Or they can raise taxes on the American public or whatever they're going to do. But the losses are still going to be there. They're going to try to shift some of them, you know, from the lenders and, you know, to the taxpayers, you know, either right away or to the taxpayers by, you know, borrowing more money from the Chinese and the Japanese. But this is not going to solve the problem. What it will do is it will, you know, immediately stop many of the homes from going into foreclosure that would have gone into foreclosure right away. So that will mitigate the number of homes on the market. But it won't do anything for the demand side. Because remember, in order to sell a house, you need a buyer. And going forwards, right, all the tighter lending standards are going to be in place. There's not going to be any more subprime. No one's going to be issuing any new mortgages like that. So now that we took away all the nothing down, no documentation, interest-only type mortgages, the houses that are on the market can't be sold. And so even though there won't be as many foreclosures on the market immediately, the reduction in demand is going to mean that prices have to plunge. So this is not going to stop home prices from collapsing. And once home prices collapse, even the people who have got these low rates locked in from Fannie Mae and Freddie, they're still not going to make their payments. Because if you have a $500,000 mortgage on a $200,000 condo, why make the payments? You know,
wouldn't it be fairly simpler for the homeowner to just call the bank and say, look, I'll pay you 4%, and you either can, if you don't agree to that, then I'll just let you foreclose and you can lose all the money. Doesn't the homeowner really have the upper hand here over the financial institution?
Well, the homeowner, the banks don't even have the mortgages. The mortgages are in these pools, and the pools are owned by hedge funds or foreign central banks. They don't even know who to call.
Right, but whoever it is calling the homeowner and saying, we want our money, can't the homeowner just say, look, I'm going to give you half of what you want in interest, and you can either take it or leave it, and basically whoever's holding these mortgages is going to have to take that lower rate or foreclose, and by foreclosing, they're going to lose a lot of money. They don't want to lose.
Everybody's going to lose a lot of money. I don't know. All the money that was lent to overpay for houses has been blown. You know, Americans borrowed a lot of money, and they sent it to China and Japan to buy big screen TVs and SUVs. But you know, real estate prices are going to collapse, and all this money has been blown. And you know, they can try to find ways to push off the day of reckoning, but it's already unraveling. I mean, the credit market is drying up. I mean, look at Wells Fargo last week. They moved up on Friday. They announced that prime mortgages, jumbo mortgages, which are above $400,000, which is, you know, below the medium home price in California, they said we're going to raise the rate on a prime loan from 6 7/8 to 8% in 1 week. The fixed rates went to 8%. I mean, that's huge.
But what I'm asking is, don't you think that is going to be reversed significantly, and they're going to end up, instead of going from 6 to 8, they're going to go from 6 to 4?
No, they're not. They're going to keep going up. because nobody wants to. People, the lenders don't want to lend money on these inflated real estate values because they know. Look, if somebody goes and buys a house today, based on the current market in California, and let's say they pay $800,000 or $900,000 for the house, the lender knows that if they can't make their payments and they have to sell it in foreclosure, they're going to get maybe 30 or 40% less. They don't want to make the loans.
And here's what's hard for me to believe in what you're saying, Peter, is you're saying that lenders are just going to quit lending. I find that hard to believe because, I mean, that's how they make money.
No, they have to get paid back. They don't want to lend irresponsibly. See, when lenders lend money, they have to be concerned about getting paid back and their interest. They don't lend money for the sake of lending it. They need to get paid back. So the first thing they have to do is make sure that they're going to get their money back, and they got to make sure there's collateral behind the loan. Because they have to know that the borrower is good for the money. You know,
but I'm saying, in retrospect, the people who bought in the last couple of years, the lenders know that the home is worth less than the contract price.
Right, it's worth way less.
Right, and so aren't they simply in a position where they're just going to have to say, look, all right, well, pay us whatever you do.
Certainly, I don't know what they're going to do, renegotiate with the buyer, but you're talking about going forward. You're thinking that interest rates on new mortgages are going to go down. They're not. I mean, yes, maybe the person that's already, you know, in debt has some leverage with the bank, and maybe they can negotiate a lower rate. But you're talking about a brand new buyer. If somebody owns a house right now and they want to sell it, somebody has to go and find a new lender, and they're not going to be able to do it. Not unless they can put 20% down, not unless they're willing to pay a much higher rate of interest, document their income. So all I'm trying to say is home prices are going to collapse. Nothing the government is doing is going to prevent that from happening. The government can socialize the losses. The government can try to bail out the lenders and the borrowers by just throwing taxpayer money at them or borrowing money from China. They can create a lot of inflation. But what they can't do is stop home prices from coming down.
A final question. Like Hillary Clinton and today the housing secretary and these market commentators, they're all saying we don't want to bail out the lenders, but we want to bail out the homeowner buyers.
Well, in many cases, the homeowners don't need to get bailed out. I mean, how do you bail somebody out who bought their house with nothing down? They're not losing anything. I mean, basically, if somebody bought a house that they couldn't afford and now they're losing it to foreclosure, why do they need to be bailed out? They couldn't afford the house in the first place. They bought it with...
I agree, but here's the question, Peter. I'm not so worried about the homeowners because they can simply walk away. I think they actually have the upper hand here vis-a-vis the lending institutions. My question is, how do you see... In the last 3 days, we've seen a huge surge in the prices of, like, Fannie Mae is up 20% in the last 3 days. Do you see this government bailout that's being contemplated, and which I think will occur, do you think that will, in fact, save these financial institutions?
No. I mean, they're going to lose money. There's no way there's going to be a bailout where they don't lose a bunch of money. The government.
Do you account for the surge in home builders and stocks and financial, like Merrill Lynch?
Home builders are done. They're done. Because we're not going to be building any new homes. The home builders are done. The reason the stocks have rallied is you got some short covering. They had a big drop. They made 52-week lows. These stocks are down 80%. They're having a bounce. Home building is dead. It doesn't matter if they can save the lenders. People are going to stop building homes. We've built too many. We have a glut of property on the market. We have way too many homes. The last thing we need to do is build more of them. Okay, and that's all going to stop. So
why is
dead?
Why is Beazer Homes and Bear Stearns and Morgan Stanley stocks up so huge in the last 3 days, Peter?
It's because they're bouncing. They don't go down in a straight line. Some shorts are covering. It doesn't mean anything. Look how many big bounces the home builder stocks had, you know, a few months ago. These stocks have been dropping. They've had plenty of bounces, and then they've collapsed and made new lows. Nothing goes down in a straight line. You know, so don't infer anything positive because stocks are rising. Beazer was up 24% today, but it's still only at $15. The stock's been falling from $80. And there have been several times, you know, Beazer went down to $35, and then it had a rally up to $45. That was a $10 rally. Then it fell down to $25. Then it rallied back to $40. Then it dropped down to $8. So now it's rallied back to $15. Doesn't mean it's not going to $5.
I watched your interviews just before I talked to you. Do you think, given what you said in your last three interviews, do you think this would be a good time to buy foreign currencies?
Of course. Of course, it's always a good time to, you know, with, you know, with the good best time to buy foreign currencies is whenever you got money. I mean, the dollar is going to go down. I mean, it's living on borrowed time.
Is that even preferable to buying foreign stocks, given the fact that equity prices seem to be somewhat inflated all over the world at this time?
I still like foreign stocks because I think equity prices are going to get even more inflated. But, I like foreign stocks better than domestic stocks. I like foreign currency better than domestic currency. I like foreign bonds better than domestic bonds. So whatever asset you want to buy, you're better off buying it abroad. And I still like the alternatives to currencies, which is precious metals. I like gold. I like silver. Anyway, thanks for the call, and let me take a quick break, and I have a couple more people on hold. I'm going to play the commercial, and we'll be right back.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that is passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, and we are back. And let me, I got one call that just came in from Germany, so let me take him first. I'm not sure if he's calling long distance or anything. And so I'll take the Germany call, and then I'll pick up in the queue. Go ahead, Frank. Frank, are you there?
I think not enough people are listening to you. And what I want to tell you is my experience with real estate in Munich, which is one of the most expensive places in Germany, is it is very, very sad. Today I have been to my bank officer, and he told me, well, he didn't told me. I saw it in the advertisements in front of the banking place. There are so many strange places they want to sell, and for so high amount of money, it makes absolutely no sense. And I have been involved in the real estate as a buyer in 2003, and it was really horrible for me. It sent me more or less to hospital because it was really a scam. And that's it, what I want to tell you for the... It's not a question. That is the reality here.
Well, the reality in the United States is real estate speculating became the national pastime. The entire country was convinced that the secret to riches and wealth was in owning real estate. And the idea was it didn't matter how much you paid because real estate prices would always go up. And it became so easy for people to buy real estate without any money. They didn't have to risk a quarter. They didn't even have to have good credit. They didn't have to have jobs. They could have no money and walk away with the keys to a $500,000 or $1 million townhome or house. And so everybody overpaid for real estate. Everybody thought they were rich. Everybody went out and spent a lot of money buying new cars, buying new television sets, buying clothes, taking vacations, buying new cars. All because of the wealth they assumed that they had and that they were going to perpetually generate through ever-expanding home prices. And so we had this huge bubble, and a lot of people got sucked into it. A lot of lenders lent a lot of money on this fantasy. And now reality is catching up. The prices are coming down, and a lot of money is going to be lost. And we're going to find out that the last 6 or 7 years had nothing to do with the strong U.S. economy. It was all because we borrowed a lot of money against a non-existent home equity and spent it. And we're going to have to pay the piper for this. Unfortunately, the tab is going to be huge.
Yeah, and the problem is that we in Germany talk now about our problems with our banks because some of them have been involved in this business.
Well, the thing is, this...
Especially with the U.S.
our real estate bubble has been so big that we've sucked in lenders from all around the world. You know, and a lot of foreign central banks own all this crap. You know, that's why U.S. representatives are going to China all the time. We're trying to convince these guys, you know, this is a big roadshow. We're trying to get these guys to buy our debt. But anyway, I'm glad I got you listening over there in Germany. Have you had a chance to read my book over there?
Tomorrow I get a visit from my aunt from Charleston, from U.S. And, I will order the books, maybe two copies, and give them to her.
All right, great. Well, thanks. Thanks for staying up late to listen to me.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Frank. Glad to know. You know, every show we seem to get somebody calling from Europe or Asia or, you know, certainly Canada, Australia. So we got an international audience. Let's take a call from Ken back in Minnesota. Go ahead, Ken. Ken, are you there? Oh, all right, Ken's gone. How about Jeff from Los Angeles?
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Yeah, I have an account with you, and I also read your book, and I pass it on to my uncle, so hopefully he'll get something out of it. I just had a question about how does another nation peg their currency to the dollar, and at the same time they might inflate or deflate their currency. How does that work?
The whole idea, I mean, obviously a government can peg the currency. They can basically say, okay, our currency is going to be worth, you know, $3 or one-to-one with the dollar. But then they have to have a monetary policy to support that. Now, normally what would happen is if you peg your currency to the dollar, the whole idea is that the dollar is a stronger currency, and you peg it to the dollar to impose some external discipline. Right, you know, a lot of times these countries would say, look, they'd want to create confidence in their currency. So the way they would do that is say, look, we're going to tie it to the dollar, which would mean they couldn't print too much money, because if they printed too much money, you know, they wouldn't be able to defend the exchange rate, because they have to defend it in the market. So they have to accumulate trade surplus, they have to accumulate foreign exchange reserves, so that they can use those reserves to buy their currency and maintain their relationship, peg relationship to the dollar. The problem with China, it's the reverse. The Chinese have pegged their currency to the dollar, but instead of the dollar providing discipline to China, it's doing the reverse. Because in order to maintain the peg, they have to be as irresponsible as us. See, normally when you peg your currency to the dollar, you're trying to keep your currency from falling against the dollar. But what the Chinese are trying to do is keep their currency from rising against the dollar, which makes no sense. You don't want to peg your currency to a weaker currency, because that encourages bad policy. It encourages inflationary monetary policy. It defeats the very purpose of the peg in the first place. So, I mean, it's all ridiculous.
What about some small South American country that owes a lot of money to the IMF, and they basically aren't they kind of just basically threatening them so they have to keep that peg?
Well,
otherwise,
yeah, I mean, normally these smaller countries are required. They want them to be pegged because they don't want to get paid back in funny money, in inflated money. They need to have some discipline. But what China is doing with this peg is the opposite. And it's a giant subsidy to America. I mean, America, we're the ones, you know, ultimately, when the dollar collapses, we're going to have to peg the dollar to something. And I think it's likely to be gold. I mean, if we're going to try to regain confidence in the dollar after it collapses, we're going to have to convince the world that the dollar has some value. And we're only going to be able to do that if we can make it, you know, redeemable in something like gold. I don't think the United States is going to want to, you know, say, hey, we're going to, you know, we'll peg our currency to the euro. I don't think they want to acknowledge that. So I think the United States, if they want to have some independence, they're going to have to find some way to give the dollar value again. And, you know, they're going to have to make it convertible or redeemable or something in something else.
Uh-huh. I just had one other question. I also have a 401k, and I was looking at some of your current issue list. Is that the most current? The one you have on your website?
There's a page on the website that's like widely held issues. That's,
yes.
You know, I put that together years ago, and a lot of those stocks on there are stocks I've never even recommended. I mean, they're stocks that people were buying, and so I put links to stocks that my clients were buying. Sometimes I recommended them. Sometimes they bought them because they read about them in the newsletter. If you really want to know what we're recommending, just call up and talk to one of the brokers. That's how you know what we're actually recommending. And, in fact, because of the NASD, we can't actually put recommendations up on the website because then, you know, we don't know who's on the website. You know, we have to control. We can only make recommendations to people if we know if the recommendation is suitable given their circumstances. So you can't just make a broad recommendation. We have to do it on an individual basis. So if you really want to know the stocks we're recommending, and it's a great time to call because a lot of the stocks I like have gotten clobbered in the last couple of weeks. You know, because a lot of the stocks I buy, these high dividend paying foreign stocks, they've become very popular with the hedge fund community because they're great to own because of the positive carry. And I think a lot of these funds have had margin calls recently, and there's been a lot of selling, and so that's knocked down the prices of some of the stocks we've been buying. And I think it's, you know, it's a great time for people to pick up either more shares if they already own some, or, you know, if they don't own any, it's a great time to, you know, to begin buying.
Okay, yeah, I did get that list. It looked like most of those I couldn't get through my 401k, so.
Yeah, no, just have an account with us. That's the key.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for the call. And I think I've also got Calvin on the line from North Carolina. You there, Cal?
How are you, Peter?
I'm good. How are you?
Not bad, not bad. I was wondering if you were going to be at that the money show in Washington, D.C. on the 6th through the 8th.
No. What month is it?
September.
September? Yeah, no. The next money show I'm scheduled to go to is the one in Orlando. I think that, I've only went to the one in Washington, D.C. one time, and it was pretty small, so I guess it wasn't really worth bringing a bunch of people there. Plus, it was really hot. I guess maybe it won't be as hot in September. I think when we went before, it was either July or August, and it was really terrible.
Gotcha. I'm hearing a lot of other analysts on CNBC and panelists they've got on there taking your positions that you've been preaching about for quite a while now.
You know, even Joe Battipaglia, who's always one of my opponents in these bull debates,
he did.
Starting to say a lot of the stuff that he was criticizing me for saying.
I know. It's amazing. But you may have already commented. I just cut on my radio, but the article that was on your website today about China and the nuclear option, have you commented on that?
Yeah, earlier in the show.
Okay. All right, I'll go back and play it on the archives. Very good. Well, that was my main...
It should be getting a lot more attention in the mainstream media. You know, they shouldn't just shrug it off that, they'll never do that, mutually assured destruction. No, it's not. It's just, it assures our destruction, not theirs.
Well, enjoy your show. Enjoy listening to you.
All right, thanks. Thanks for the call.
Yes, sir. Bye-bye.
Yeah, you know, I didn't even do the money show in San Francisco this time. It's been getting, you know, troubling. We're getting so many clients and so many people contacting us that I really don't have the need to go out, you know, and look for business the way I used to years ago. But we will be doing Orlando and probably Vegas again. In any event, you know, it's amazing too. When you talk about these commentators on these shows, you know, the people that are coming on TV and who are assuring everybody that everything is fine, assuring people that there's no threat to the broader economy from what's happening in the mortgage market. These are the same people that didn't even predict this, that were convinced that the housing market was sound, that everything was going to be great in 07, housing prices were going to keep going up, there was no housing bubble, the economy was in great shape. Then, when we found out about the subprime problems, these are the same people that said it's contained to subprime, it's only a subprime problem. And then, of course, as that's proven, I mean, they constantly come out and say, it's okay, it's not going to get worse, this is the bottom, it's going to get better. And it's amazing that they have any credibility whatsoever. Yet I'm the one guy that comes on these shows who they all laugh at and make fun of. Yet I'm the only person who's been accurately predicting what was going to happen. As I said, you know, I was rewatching some of my Fox clips. I mean, some of the Fox clips on my website are absolutely hysterical. You can go back and listen to the predictions I made in late 06 and very early 07 about the housing market and hear what these people were saying and hear how they were laughing at me and making fun of me. And then these are the same people that are still on these shows today, you know, talking about how it's no big deal. You know, and of course, you know, when I said this stuff was going to happen, they were like, oh, that's impossible. And of course, they were wrong, but now they think that it doesn't matter. They just can't put two and two together. You know, they just do not appreciate the severity of this problem. They do not appreciate the U.S. economy. Or you know, they keep saying, I heard a guy on the radio today, they were saying, well, it's a good thing that we're having all these problems when we have such a great economy. We have such a strong economy, so we can absorb it. I mean, talk about having your head in the sand. We don't have a great economy. We don't have a strong economy. We have a phony economy that was made possible by all these loans, all this access to cheap credit, which is going away. So the very thing that's crumbling is the very support to this economy that they all think is so great. So it's like, you know, the foundation of the economy is being knocked out from under it, yet they're still looking at the economy thinking that it's going to stand without that foundation. It just shows you how clueless they are. But, you know, of course, we know they're clueless. If they understood this, they wouldn't have been making fun of me 6 months ago when I was talking about this stuff. They would have been agreeing with me. So the fact of the matter is they didn't understand the situation back then, and they still don't understand the situation. And that's why. But, you know, I'm still waiting for somebody on one of these shows to actually say something, like, you know, to give me kudos or something. You know, I sent Mark Haynes that list. You know, one time I was on the show, and they were making fun of me. And I said, you know, Mark, you shouldn't be making fun of me considering all the accurate predictions I've made on this show. And he said, oh, why don't you send me a list? And I sent him a list that day of at least 12 or 15 of the predictions that I had made that had already come true. And he hasn't read that list on the air yet. So, you know, but I sent it to him, you know. But I remember one time I was watching a show that when I sent him a list, he commented. He said, I have a list in my hand here from Peter Schiff. So he mentioned the list, but he never read anything off the list. But, you know, if anybody wants to send an email to Squawk Box, you know, to Mark Haynes, you might say, hey, are you ever going to read Peter Schiff's list? But I'm hoping that somebody on one of these shows, you know, would say something to the effect that, hey, you know, you were right on this one. Good call. But, you know, it seems like they're almost afraid to acknowledge that I'm right on anything, because then maybe they have to acknowledge that I might be right on all these other things that I'm talking about, and people don't want to acknowledge the fact that I might be right on these bigger issues. Anyway, the lines are free, so let me give the number again to call. It's 888-678-9597. 888-678-9597. And, you know, if you go back and you reread, you know, if you go into my book and you reread the chapter on real estate, chapter 7, and, you know, you go back and read on my website, read the stuff that I've been writing over the past several years, and listen to my archives, and there's been some interviews that I've done. In fact, on YouTube, they have one of these videos of the bursting about the housing bubble, and they have some of my voiceovers from a radio show I did. I think it wasn't on my show. But I described everything that happened to a T. I mean, I talked about how the credit markets would seize up, how the people on, you know, that were buying all these securitized products, how they were going to start to lose money, and that when they started to lose money, they wouldn't want to lend anymore, and that once Wall Street couldn't repackage and sell all these mortgages they were buying, particularly subprime, that the whole market would implode, that there would no, they wouldn't be able to do it. That's why when I went and spoke at these conferences, if there's anybody listening to this show that was at one of these conferences, I spoke twice in Las Vegas at the Western Regional Mortgage Bankers Association. And when I spoke there, my whole presentation was about why the whole business was going to come to an end, why all these companies that were exhibiting were going to be out of business, because I said it's all a function of the secondary market for these bonds. And once the buyers realize that they're, you know, they can't get paid back, it's all going to come to an end. And I predicted it exactly the way it unfolded. I mean, that's why I sent out an email to my entire database looking for accredited investors, because a friend of mine had set up a hedge fund to short these BBB- subprime bonds, and I urged all my accredited clients to invest in this hedge fund. And those people who did, I mean, the fund is up about 350% year to date. Meaning, if somebody invested $100,000 at the beginning of the year, they've got $450,000 now. And the reason they made that money, and of course, it's too late to make that easy money. I mean, it's no longer the layup it was 6 months ago. But they were able to short these bonds where they were still at par. Now they're worth 30 cents. And of course, you know, there's no more secondary market for this subprime debt. And so, you know, the market is gone. You know, we can't. You know, the reason, like, when people use it, you'd ask your question, how can somebody, you know, go in and buy a house with no down payment, right, risk none of his own money, you know, without the lender even documenting that he has a job, that he has any income, without looking at his credit history, you know, why would a person like that be able to get a loan? Well, because the people buying the loan didn't care. They didn't ask any questions, right? The people originating the loan knew that they were just going to originate it and resell it. And Wall Street was buying it, packaging it up, and the people buying it believed the credit ratings. They believed the ratings that Moody's and S&P were putting on, and they felt there's no need to worry about whether or not the guy can repay because they just looked at the credit ratings. Well, now that everybody realizes that those ratings are bullshit, right, people now don't want to buy these things. And so now that they don't want to buy them, it goes all the way back to the original lender. Now there's nobody who's willing to buy a mortgage from a guy that has no down payment, that didn't document his income. Because remember, like the other caller said, they said, why don't banks just loan money? They want to get paid back. You don't just lend money for the sake of lending it. You know, just because the borrower can make the interest payments for a while. I mean, what good is it if you lend somebody $1 million and they make interest payments for a few years and they're paying you 5 or 6% and then they stop? I mean, you got to get that $1 million back. So that's the very first thing. It's not the return on your money that's paramount. It's the return of your money. So you're not going to make a loan if you don't think you're going to get your money back. You know. Anyway, I've got a couple more calls that have come in. Let me take a quick commercial break, and we will come back for the last segment and the callers.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that has passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, we are back. And I've got, I think we've got four calls on hold now, so I would say no more, because we don't have enough time to take any more calls than the four we have on hold. So let me start with Sam calling from Alabama. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, I was just curious if you saw what Richard Russell wrote about you last Friday.
Yeah, I somebody sent that to me. He kind of casually mentioned me in reference to my, you know, gloom and doom scenario, and said that, you know, there are other people that kind of harbor those feelings. I think that's about all he said, right?
Yeah, I guess the point I was curious about is, why do people have such a hard time understanding that even if the dollar doesn't collapse tomorrow, that if you're invested in countries that have a better fiscal situation than we do in a Warren Buffett-style investment, you can still make money in the interim?
Well, did Richard Russell infer otherwise or imply otherwise?
But that was my sense. I mean, saying, well, the market's going up here in the meantime, but in prices of eggs, as you've said, or barrels of oil or grams of gold, it's going down. Why do people
have
such a hard time with that?
It's really ironic, and I might try to mention this on the air tomorrow. It's a great thing. But I went and I did an interview with the Wall Street Journal at the Wall Street Journal the other day. And down in the lobby, they have a picture of the Wall Street Journal from when the Dow hits 10,000 for the first time. And it was from 2000, right, when the Dow hit 10,000. And you think, well, gee, in 1980 the Dow was at 10,000, now it's at 13,000 and change, so the Dow's gone up, right? Well, the price of you can look up in the right-hand corner, you can see the price of the Wall Street Journal. The price of the daily Wall Street Journal was 75 cents. Today, 7 years later, the price of the Wall Street Journal is $1.50. I mean, so the Wall Street Journal is the price is doubled, and the Dow is only up 35%. So how's the Dow going up?
I couldn't agree with you more. Look forward to
it. And it's this perfect example, just looking at the Wall Street Journal. And I'm pretty sure it was $1.50. I mean, maybe it was $1.25, but I think it was $1.50.
No, it's $1.50 now.
Yeah, so it's doubled. And, you know, how can they with straight face say there's no inflation? And not only has the price of the Wall Street Journal doubled, but it's smaller. I think they added color to it, but the paper's half the size.
Well, the Times just did that this week.
Oh, shrunk down?
Yeah, and where I get it down here, it's down an inch and a half and up to a buck and a quarter.
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. So where's the hedonics? Why isn't the government adjusting that up and saying, well, the price is really a bigger price increase because they're giving you less paper?
Only when it's to their advantage.
Yep, you know it.
Have a great day.
Thanks for the call. Okay, let's skip over to Sam from Alabama. Go ahead, Sam. What did I just do, Sam?
Brian.
Brian from North Carolina.
Yes, I saw on the CNBC show you were talking with a Diane Swonk.
Well, I wasn't talking with her. I've been on the show a few times. Diane Swonk is an economist for one of these banks, who was also one of the big, you know, cheerleaders of the tech boom, the internet boom, back in the 1990s. But I've had a couple of lively discussions, you know, with her as an opponent in these bull bear debates. One of the biggest ones when we had a big discussion on inflation. But anyway, I was just on with her, I think, you know, within the last couple of weeks.
Yes, I saw that, and I thought that she was off base. I actually Googled her name, and I read her bio, and of course she's been advisors to the economic, to the Federal Reserve Board and the economic advisors, so she's going to take that position. But I was kind of surprised that they use the term conspiracy. I never heard you say that.
Well, I never say there's a conspiracy, and I never say that the government officials that are calculating the CPI are lying. See, they're trying to make it out like what I'm saying is that, you know, the government is calculating the inflation numbers, and they're getting a big number, like a high number. And then behind the scenes, they're saying, oh, we can't allow this, and so they're finding a way to change it, and it's a conspiracy to give us phony numbers. And I've never said that. All I've said is that back in the 1990s, the government changed the methodology for the way you calculate it. So the people at the Bureau of Labor Statistics are doing what the government told them to do. They're calculating the CPI based on a certain way of doing it. And the way they do it gives you a low result. That if consumer prices are going up by 10%, you know, maybe the way they calculate them, they only go up by 3%. But it's not a conspiracy. It's just the way they have to do it.
Well, no, I never heard that. But, never heard the word conspiracy out of your mouth.
Well, they try to say that because the minute you talk about conspiracy, then you make the other person sound like a fool.
Exactly.
I think there's this giant conspiracy. Just like whenever people tell me, oh, I wrote a book that's gloom and doom, I predict the end of the world. I don't predict the end of the world. I'm not even pessimistic on the global economy. I'm optimistic. I'm only pessimistic on the U.S. economy. But they try to act like I'm predicting Armageddon and the end of the world to try to discredit the negative things I'm saying about the United States. But, I'm very optimistic on the global economy, and I've been saying all along, and one of the reasons I like buying foreign stocks is I think the global economy will prosper. I think they will do much better when they no longer have to support the American consumer.
Now,
I think that we're a big burden on the rest of the world. I don't think that they benefit from our lack of production and our borrowing.
Now, the guy that is on CNBC that's in Chicago markets, he's starting to talk about the dollar more. He'll get a blurb in about, you know, the dollar value.
Mm-hmm.
So he's kind of picking up on your, on your stance.
Yeah, I think I know the guy you're talking about. He reports from the exchange, yeah, the Chicago exchange.
Exactly.
Yeah, he's mentioning, he's talking about the dollar going down. He's starting to talk about foreign markets priced in dollars. Yeah, I mean, he's starting, and more and more people are going to start to notice that, and eventually people are going to realize that the market's not going anywhere.
Exactly.
You know, they're going to figure out what my clients already know. I mean, all these people accuse me of giving out bad investment advice, and people following my advice, you know, they're missing out on these great returns, and, you know, people following my advice aren't missing out on anything. They're getting better returns.
In fact, I hear more and more people talking about foreign investing now.
I know. I mean, it's picking up, but people forget, and even the people that are recommending U.S. stocks, the U.S. stocks that are doing well are all the ones that are doing exports. I mean, Cisco Systems had this big jump up today, and I would never buy that stock because I think it's all they do is transfer their income to their employees with their stock options. But they had a record quarter. They had a big jump in earnings, all because of overseas sales. I mean, all these companies in the U.S. that are doing well are doing so because of strength abroad, you know, and it's despite weakness here at home.
Exactly. Well, God bless you, babe. I enjoy listening to you.
You read my book yet?
Yes, I have.
Great. Are you telling your friends about it?
I've told everybody about it.
All right, great. We got to get more copies out there before.
Absolutely.
Thanks for the call.
Yes.
Let's go to Bob from Florida. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
The reason I called was talking about your credibility on CNBC and Fox and all those people. And I'd say most of your clients, like myself, I mean, we just look at these programs and laugh because they can't really acknowledge you. If they gave you credibility, I mean, you just would expose their whole cover. And the whole thing would just start, people would start panicking. And so they got to put you down somehow and try to make you look like you say, a conspiracy and this and that. Because once they find out you're the credible person in the whole show, I mean, I think it would have an effect on the market. But they're all up and up.
One of the reasons that a lot of the hosts or the anchors have such a hard time with what I say is because it's so opposite of what everybody else says. So here they are day after day coming to work, you know, and you know they spend their day with all these other people that are showing up that are industry shills, and they're all saying the same thing. And I come along and say all these people are wrong. It doesn't even psychologically. They don't even want to accept that that's true, because then they have to acknowledge that the rest of their day is all, you know, they're just spreading propaganda.
Yes, exactly.
They want to feel good about what they're doing. I mean, that's what everybody wants, to feel good about their job. So psychologically, you have these kind of defense mechanisms.
Right.
And so they just want to shut down. And some of these guys, they don't want to acknowledge what I'm saying.
Yes. No. Yeah. You're almost like the lone warrior out there. You and Jim Rogers and Martin Weiss, I follow. And I mean, you fellows are all in the same camp, and you're saying the same thing. But they've got to destroy you.
Yeah, I mean, they talk about, every time I see someone talk about Jimmy Rogers, you know, every time, you know, all they do is snicker and they kind of laugh at him like he's kind of kook. You know, meanwhile, look at what the guy's been saying. Yeah, has he been 100% accurate? Has every investment call he's made been right? No. And these guys will pick out one thing he said. Oh, the long bond will never go below 6%. Okay, it did. Big deal, you know.
Right.
But he said a lot more things that were right than were wrong.
Exactly.
They have these other guys that come on that have constantly wrong. They have all these people that come on the show that were cheerleaders for the dot-coms in 1999 and 2000. Almost every guest on CNBC and Fox, if you can play their CNBC clips and Fox clips from 1999 and 2000, to a man, they were wildly bullish. They were saying, buy the blue chips in the Internet, buy all this crap, NASDAQ 6000, NASDAQ 7000, it's a new era, and they were all wrong. Jimmy Rogers was one of the few guys that was coming on TV saying it was nonsense.
Right, right. And also, you were talking about the Wall Street Journal. I'm up on Cape Cod, Mass. And, the Wall Street Journal at the newsstand just went from $1 up to $1.50 in the last 2 weeks.
$1.50, and it was it was 75 cents in 2000.
Yeah.
75 cents. Yeah, there's no inflation in those 7 years. The price has doubled.
Yes, exactly. And I'm a client, and like you mentioned earlier, our stocks have taken a hit in the last couple of weeks, so we just stay the course and you just ride it out, I guess, right?
Oh, yeah. In fact, they've already started to come back. We've had some big jumps in a lot of our stocks in the last couple of days. Some of our stocks, some of the ones in Singapore and Asia, have been really looking strong. In Hong Kong, they've made new highs even in the last week. But some of our stuff in Australia and Europe, some of the REITs and the utilities, have really been clobbered. But they've been down like 10%, and for no reason. And I think it's all a question of liquidity. I think a lot of the carry traders were having to blow out of some of these stocks. And I think it's a great time. I think it's a great time for people to add to their position. So, you know, phone call your broker. If you have any extra cash or if there's any dividends lying around your account, make sure it gets put to work on this pullback.
Yes. Very good. That's all I wanted to say.
Thanks for the call, Bob.
Talk to you. Bye.
And the last caller of the evening is going to be John calling from Canada.
How you doing? Peter?
Yes.
How you doing? It's John.
Hey, John.
I'm actually calling to ask you about your 6-month outlook, maybe 12-month outlook on gold and the HUI.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm always looking for gold to go up. You know, I mean, maybe that's just an emotional bias. You know, I tend to always think it's going to go up, and it just always surprises me that it doesn't, you know. And every time we break out and make new highs on the gold stocks, the next thing you know, we're getting clobbered. And this is, you know, we made new highs a few weeks ago, and we got clobbered. Of course, all the gold stocks are up big today. You know, gold was only up a little bit today, a couple of bucks. Silver was basically flat. I don't know. I mean, I think the main reason that the gold is not taking off right now is because the dollar index is bouncing around 80, and I think a lot of people are betting that maybe this is the floor. Maybe the dollar is going to rally from here, and people don't want to get long gold in advance of a dollar rally. But I think if the dollar fails the support level and it breaks down and it's going lower, then I think gold's going to take off. And I think the gold stocks will go up. I mean, some of the North American stocks are looking really strong. I mean, we had some really weak. I mean, look what happened to Harmony Gold. I mean, they came out with some losses, and they just shot the stock. I mean, the stock, you know, was down like a third or a quarter in 2 days. But the South Africans are having trouble making money because the gold price is just too low relative to what it costs them to mine the stuff.
Yeah, here we
go. They're still making money. I mean, Barrick Gold came out with good earnings. And this stock looks very strong. Newmont finally today looks like it broke out of a little bit of the downtrend. It was one of the stronger stocks on the day, which, you know, I guess a lot of people like to see Newmont doing well because it's one of the go-to stocks that's been underperforming. And I don't know, I mean, I'm bullish. I mean, I've been bullish before, although we did make new highs in the UE and the XAU, I think, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
But, you know, they had a pretty violent correction. But, you know, I think if you really want to make a lot of money investing right now, you know, and you're willing to take the risk that I'm wrong, because I think there's a lot more risk in the gold sector than there is just buying REITs and utilities. But if you really want to buy stocks that might go up 5 or 10 times, you know, these gold stocks can do it. I mean, they can easily do it. I mean, if gold does what I think it's going to do, which is, you know, go to several thousand dollars an ounce, I mean, where do you think these stocks are going to be?
Yeah.
Especially when people, I mean, if you add it up, every single gold stock that existed, the market cap is still less than many of the stocks, the individual stocks in the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm.
And they're so under-owned. Very few people own gold or own gold stocks. And if investors generally realize that, hey, I want to have 5 or 10% of my account in gold stocks, I mean, you can't do that without a major move up.
Yeah.
And so I've been expecting this, and that's why my personal, and I mentioned on the show, that I have far more mining stocks in my personal account than in any of the accounts of my clients, because I'm taking a lot more risk with my money than I'm taking with other people's money. And I generally discourage people from gambling too much, and I try to get them to be more conservative. But for myself, I don't necessarily take that advice, because I'm being more aggressive in that I'm so convinced that I'm right, that I want to have a bigger payday when I am. But, you know, for a lot of my clients, I try to always think in my mind, okay, what if I'm wrong? What if I'm not right? And that's where this approach of these foreign stocks and these dividend-paying stocks, because even if I'm wrong, I don't see how we go wrong with these investments. I just really don't, especially if you have a long-term time horizon. Certainly over a year or two, if the dollar were to jump by 10 or 20%, which is possible, and foreign stocks were to drop by 10%, it's possible that these stocks would go down. But I can't see that they'll stay down. In the meantime, we're collecting good dividends. The dividends are better than what we get in a bond or a CD. So what's the problem? You know, if they go down, we don't have to sell them. You know, when stocks drop, it's only a problem for people who have to sell. It's not a problem if you're not in over your head and you're collecting dividends. You can pick the time when you want to sell. And if you're in control, like, see, when people borrow money and are on leverage and they get margin calls or they have a liquidity event, they need to sell. You never want to be in a position where you need to sell. You always want to be in a position where you can pick your time to sell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that way, if the market is low, you don't have to sell. That's why, like, a lot of these guys that follow Wall Street Pied Pipers, and they say, well, you know, you buy all these stocks that don't pay any dividends, and then when you retire, you sell them, then you move into bonds. Well, what if when you want to retire, the stock market is way down? Then what do?
Yeah, you just,
you know, that's why my approach is you buy the dividend-paying stocks now. And if you don't need the dividends, you reinvest them to compound your returns. And then when you retire, you simply change the option from reinvest dividends to send me my dividends. You don't have to worry about where the market is when you retire, because it doesn't matter. You're not looking to sell. But right now you have an entire baby boom loaded up with high multiple non-dividends paying stocks. How the hell are they ever going to sell?
Mm-hmm. You were saying that significant percentage of portfolios in gold and gold stocks, more so
yes.
than what you recommend to your clients. Do you mind me asking how high you went personally?
Well, I mean, first of all, my personal account is on margin, okay? So it screws it all up. I have a large margin debit in my account, so I've borrowed money.
Right.
So if you net it out, I'm probably 75% of my portfolio is gold stocks, if you take into account the margin, because I'm about 130%, 140% invested. But you know, if you net out the effect of the margin, I mean, if you look at the margin, then the gold stocks are probably about 50%. But if you actually figure out the equity in my account, the gold stocks represent, you know, maybe 75% of the equity in my account, because, you know, my account is leveraged.
Yeah, I'm a financial.
But, you know, and the thing is, what I've been doing with my personal account is the stuff that isn't in gold pays dividends. And I use the dividends that I collect on the types of stocks that I've got my clients in, on foreign utilities and things like that, and foreign REITs. I have a lot of the Canadian Energy Trusts, and I use all those dividends to pay my margin. So I still have a positive carry on my thing. Anyway, I'm running out of time. Thanks for the call. 10 seconds left. Thanks for listening. Remember, get my book, Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse, www.europac.net. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Tune in again next week.